This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. On this archive edition, we play back our 1995 concert and interview with songwriter, pianist, and singer Dave Frischberg. His songs have the wit that's associated with American popular song of the past, but most of his lyrics are about the anxieties and absurdities of life today. Some of the performers who have recorded his songs are Rosemary Clooney, Mel Torme, Cleo Lane, Susanna McCorkle, Blossom Dearie, Al Jarreau, and Jackie and Roy. Diana Krall's latest CD features one of Frischberg's early songs, Peel Me a Grape. Four of his own albums have earned Grammy nominations for Best Jazz Vocal. Frischberg has a new solo CD called By Himself that's part of the Arbors Records piano series. We'll hear a song from it later. Here's his 1995 concert and interview, opening with one of his wittiest songs, Quality Time.
I'll be late getting home from the office, and so will you. 'Cause we both got a million calls to return and a million things to do. We're not seeing enough of each other, 'cause truth be told, we're up to our ears in our careers, and we're putting our hearts on hold. So, darling, let me bring you up to speed. A little time together's what we need. Quality time. We both deserve a little quality time. I know a small hotel, remote and quiet. If they decide to sell, my firm could buy it. Then we develop it and gentrify it. We're talking quality time, quality time. We both have earned ourselves some quality time. In the Bahamas, we can watch our stress go. We'll walk along the beach and dine al fresco. I'll take a power lunch with Robert Vesco. We're talking quality time. Come fly with me, unwind, kick back, relax. I'll bring my laptop fax. You'll work on your new screenplay. I'll update my resume. Quality time. A little frolic and frivolity time. We'll take a seminar in self-hypnosis so we can learn to stop and smell the roses. We'll do a workshop in the grieving process. Learning to cry is no crime. We're talking quality time. We'll hit the tennis courts in our Adidas. That way the sporty sorts are bound to meet us. We'll double fault, of course, and let them beat us. We're talking quality time. We'll meet some upscale types to interface with. A wealthy couple we could share some space with. A smart attorney we could start a case with. We're talking quality time. Come dine with me. This time you choose the wine. Romance is the bottom line. And later, when we're alone, hang on, there's my other phone. We'll have a ball, but now I got to deal with this other call. We've both been chewing more than we can bite off. Both deserve at least a day and night off. I'll speak to Sid. He'll make it all a write-off. This may not cost us a dime. I'll fax you back with a plan of attack to let the quality time begin. We'll firm up the time frame. And you can pencil me in. You better pencil me in.
It's a great song. Dave Frischberg, welcome back to Fresh Air.
Oh, thanks.
Dave, what was the music that you grew up with? What was the pop music of your time when you were coming of age?
Well, I was born in 1933, so I grew up, I grew up in a house with two jitterbug older brothers. They wore saddle shoes, and my brother Mort, who was 7 years older than I, he had a keychain that he used to swing. Remember they used to wear keychains on their belt? And he used to talk on the phone and swing and twirl that keychain and in his saddle shoes, and they listened to Benny Goodman records, and that was the music. It was like Harold Teen, you know what I mean? And that was the music that was in my house when I was a kid. In other words, a 6 and 7, 8 years old, the music that I remember was Count Basie, Lester Young, Jimmy Rushing, Jay McShann with Walter Brown. They were deep into that swing music. Cab Calloway, Benny Goodman Records, Artie Shaw.
So did you aspire to have a keychain that you could swing also while you were wearing your saddle shoes and talking on the phone?
That was my first actual musical impulse, was to twirl the keychain. and I did try to be like that. I admired that music. I admired the spirit of it. I was, even as a child, a tot, I was caught up in the mystique of Lionel Hampton and Gene Krupa, and I liked to look at pictures of them. And I was deep into that music as a kid and never thought of myself as a player, but like a fan, you know.
What was your father's music, your parents' music?
My father was a singer in the temple, in the Jewish temple, you know, in the choir. He was deeply interested in liturgical music. He used to listen to Richard Tucker records and Jan Peirce and those good, you know, the good cantors. He loved cantorial music. I heard a lot of that, too. And you know what else my brothers liked that really hit me hard was Gilbert and Sullivan.
Huh.
Wow, that really stamped me. I knew all of the Mikado as a kid, and my family and I used to sing those songs together. And who's the guy? Gilbert was the guy who wrote the words. That guy, he just knocked me out. That's great lyric writing. I don't think that's ever been equaled.
Now, when you started to play piano, what did you play?
Boogie Woogie, the blues. I was blues player. When I was 12 or 13 years old, I was deep into Pete Johnson. He was my hero, Pete Johnson from Kansas City, and Joe Turner. My brother Mort, the guy with the keychain, he used to sing like Joe Turner.
Really?
Yeah, and so he and I would play the Joe Turner, Pete Johnson, Boogie Woogie records, and we would copy them. I would copy them off the record, and we would. That's how I began playing the blues. I could play in C, F, and G, the blues.
Well, I'd love to hear you play something solo at the piano. I mean, to play a piano solo.
Okay.
Well, tell us what you want to play and why. Why you've chosen it.
I haven't chosen it. Let me think.
Okay. And while you're thinking, I'll say, I really love your piano playing. So when you perform on the show, I always like to get you to play something.
Well, you know, I mentioned Jay McShann. I love that Jay McShann band from Kansas City. I can play a couple of things that I remember from the Jay McShann band, which contained Charlie Parker, by the way, that band did. So, Jumpin' Blues, you know. And Walter Brown sang with Jay McShann. That's the Confessing the Blues. That was the stuff that I used to try to play like. I loved McShann's playing, and I loved Count Basie's playing, and Pete Johnson's playing. I was hooked on the Kansas City jazz musicians.
Did you ever get to see these guys play when you were young?
Well, I had occasion to meet and play with Jay McShann and duets and stuff. That was really fun. I admired him so. And I did meet Count Basie under very odd circumstances once. I don't know if you want me to go into it. It was very strange. I was rehearsing the show for Mel Torme, who was going to arrive a few hours hence. And I was rehearsing the band, and when I got there to rehearse the band for Mel Torme, this is a very odd circumstance because I had nothing to do with Mel Torme at the time. It was one of those phone calls. And when I got there, the band was Count Basie's band, and I was rehearsing them. And Basie stepped aside, and I went to the piano and began to rehearse Count Basie's band and Mel Torme's opening number. I felt completely at a loss, and because I hadn't heard the music either. So I said, well, this first one is called, God, what was called, Dogging Around or something like that. It was a Basie piece, you know. So I said, is everybody ready? And Freddie Green was sitting there, and I said, Freddie, you don't have your music out. And he looked at me with this, just this cold look, and he says, I wrote this. I rehearsed the band, and I said, well, that's fine. And Basie, from where he was sitting, said, what do you mean that's fine? That's terrible. Let me show you how it's supposed to sound. Oh, those guys took me that day.
Oh, God.
It was fun. That was funny, actually.
Did you feel in on the joke or insulted?
Not insulted, certainly, but it was good-natured. They weren't mean guys, and I knew several of the people in the band, including the meanest, who was Marshall Royal, and he was on my side.
So how did you get to rehearse the band?
Somebody called me. Torme was going to be late, and whoever was going to rehearse was going to be late with him, and they needed somebody to rehearse the band. You know, this happened in Los Angeles years ago.
My guest is Dave Frischberg. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is songwriter, pianist, and singer Dave Frischberg. The last time I saw you perform, it was in New York a couple of years ago, and you did a song called Wallflower...
Wallflower Lonely.
Yeah, Wallflower Lonely, Cornflower Blue.
Yeah.
And it was I really liked the song a lot, and there was a very actually funny story that yeah. went along with the song, and I'd love for you to tell the story
okay,
and play the song.
Well, you know, I tell the story about how when I was first starting to write songs in New York, and I'm talking about I had moved to New York, and this was the early 60s. In those days, it was customary for a songwriter to bring the songs directly to the publisher's office, and then you sit at the piano, and you sing the song and perform it for the publisher. And the publisher, if he likes it, then he has demo records made and so forth. That was the norm. I'll shorten this up, but anyway, what happened was a guy asked me to write a cowboy song, the way he called it. Play a cowboy song. Why don't you write a cowboy song? So I came back and I wrote him. I said, I think I got a cowboy song. So this was it. This is what I wrote, you know. I'm wallflower lonely, cornflower blue. You'll never know how sad I feel remembering you. I tried to forget you. What good does it do? I'm wallflower lonely, cornflower blue. When we were together, it was sunflower weather. Today only clouds are in view. Your love made me happy more than I knew. But now I'm only wallflower lonely, cornflower blue. So that was my little entry into the country songwriting business, you know. So the guy says to me, the publisher says to me, he listens to that song, he says, you mind if I just give you a little tip on how to construct a song? I said, no, you know, please, help me out. He says, play the bridge for me. I said, okay. When we were together, it was sunflower. He says, stop. What's that chord on the word sunflower? I said, well, it's a B seventh. He said, that's where you lose them. So what are you talking about? He says, well, that's not a cowboy chord.
What, did you have a witty retort?
No, later on I thought of a witty retort, and then and when I tell the story, I pretend like I really said it at the time, but I didn't think of it till years later. I should have said to him, you mean if I play a B7th, I'll lose the audience? And he would say, yes, and then I would say, I didn't know it was that easy. But I didn't think of it at the time. As a matter of fact, I probably, in those days, I probably took him seriously and probably avoided B7th for a few weeks.
See, now that's the kind of song you probably would not have written had you not been given this, like, unusual assignment, right?
Exactly. But, you know, in those days, I was trying to write to satisfy the publishers and those people who were in the music business, the people who populated the industry. I was trying to satisfy them. So if they wanted cowboy songs, if I'm going to be a songwriter, I got to write what the market wants. So I tried to write the cowboy song, and I tried to write theatrical songs. I got involved with Frank Lesser's publishing company, and they asked me to write songs for certain properties they had in mind. It was almost a little exercise they were giving me to see how I would deal with a theatrical situation, you know?
Oh, what'd you write?
Gosh, I wrote a few songs for them. One of them I kept in my act for years after that. It was a song called Another Song About Paris that was sung by an irascible fellow in they were trying to do a musical version of Sabrina at that time. Talking about 1962, maybe. I wrote that for, I think, that one of the older men, maybe Sabrina's father. I'm not quite sure. I wrote that song. Another song about Paris. Oh. Lovers in the rain and flowers in the stall on the Rue Madeleine near the Place Pigalle. How amusing when the gypsies stole our wine. Remember Notre Dame, where we chatted with the hunchback? The dim cafe where we had to send the lunch back? Ah, Paris in the spring. It was all too divine. Another song about Paris. Is there room for one more? Is there really a note or a word we all haven't heard before? And so on, about how many songs there are about Paris and how rife with cliches there are, you know.
Well,
that
one
was
your...
a song I wrote for as an exercise almost for the lesser people that they wanted to see what I'd come up with, you know.
So what kind of feedback did they give you?
Well, they were real
what
nice.
What grade did they give you?
I'll tell you what happened. You know, I worshipped Frank Lesser, especially when I first began to write songs. He specifically was my model. I thought he was the best songwriter going. I still do think he was the best songwriter of his generation. And, you know, he was more than a songwriter. He was a great musician, although I don't think he wanted to admit it or own up to it. And, you know, a genius lyric writer. And he also was this very inventive, courageous, intrepid show person, you know, and a great businessman as well, I understand. Anyway, he called me into his office, you know. He called me on the phone or had someone call, and I had an appointment to meet him himself, and I hadn't ever met Lesser. And I sat in his office for maybe an hour or more while he discussed my songs that I had submitted to the company, and he told me how much he liked them, and he told me what I could do to improve. He wanted to talk about lyrics mostly and not about music. He said he wasn't equipped to talk about music. I said, what are you kidding? The most happy fellow. He didn't want to talk about it, you know. He said, no, let's talk about lyrics. And he told me such interesting things, insights into how he makes his decisions about lyrics. He said to me in one song, he said, look at this song, look at this colorful word you put here. He says, it's a very colorful word, and it operates beautifully in the lyric. He says, but don't squander it there. He said, put it someplace where there's a rest so that the audience can listen to that and savor it and understand it. He says, if you throw it away in the context of that jumble of notes, he said, they'll lose it. Either that, or when they hear it, their minds will be distracted and they'll miss the next few lines. You know?
Gee, how interesting. Did you make the change?
Absolutely, and he was right. He called that a sore thumb. He says, those kind of words stick out and they interrupt the flow. And when you interrupt the flow, you interrupt what the listener is listening to. He was very analytical about where to put his words and how colorful to make them.
What else did he tell you?
Well, he tried. I remember one thing he says. Some kind of anatomical reference that he didn't like. He said, "Don't, for God's sake," he said, "don't say things like my heart is breaking in two." He says, "Don't talk about the heart as if it were an organ, because then the listener sees this image of a heart, a picture of a heart breaking in two. Isn't that what you want to see at all?" He said, avoid those kind of, I guess to him they were gratuitous cliches, you know, because he was very concerned with leading the listener through the lyric and not interrupting the listener. He was very concerned with what the listener was perceiving with those lyrics.
Dave Frischberg, recorded in our studio in 1995. We'll hear more of his performance in the second half of the show. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with songwriter and pianist Dave Frischberg. His songs have been recorded by Rosemary Clooney, Jackie and Roy, Blossom Deary, and Susanna McCorkle. Before he became known as a songwriter, he was a jazz sideman. He has a new song called I Want to Be a Sideman that's featured on his new CD, Dave Frischberg by Himself. Let's hear it.
I want to be a sideman. Just an ordinary side man. I go along for the ride, man. Responsibility free. I want to fill behind the vocal. Double on flute and jam on the blues. I want to go and join the local. Buy a dark suit and start paying dues. I want to maintain my book in neatly numbered order. To listen to Lester Young on my recorder. I want to play while the people dance. I want to press my own coat and pants. I want to ask for an advance. I want to be a sideman. Just a highly qualified man, a professional pride man, old indispensable me. Now I can cut whatever comes up, fake and transpose and won't make a fuss. I want to set the vibes and drums up, sight read the shows and sleep on the bus. I want to spend all my time with music and musicians. I want to go out and grab a smoke on intermissions. I want to sleep in the afternoons and let the leader call all the tunes. I want to be young. I want to have fun. I want to be a sideman. I want to work for a superstar. I want to hang in the hotel bar. I want to be young. I want to have fun. I want to be a sideman.
Dave Frischberg from his new CD, By Himself. Back in the days when Frischberg worked primarily as a sideman, he spent a year on the road accompanying singer Carmen McRae. I asked Frischberg what kind of accompaniment worked best for her.
You know, Carmen McRae was such a good pianist herself.
That's true.
That right. It was a little intimidating for me, especially when I was a young kid and greener and less self-assured than I am now. It was intimidating for me to try to play piano for Carmen McRae because she was a terrific player. And you know, first of all, Carmen was difficult to play for because she knew exactly what she wanted to hear. And if she didn't hear it, she'd be very coldly disappointed, and sometimes publicly so.
Ooh.
So it was always kind of a hairy experience. I never, you know, I always wanted to please her so much, and we all did. And she was tough to please. But then I would notice I'd get off the stand during a certain part of the show, and Carmen would go to the piano and play for herself. And suddenly she'd become a different singer. She'd be completely different singer when she was playing for herself. In the first place, her accompaniment was exactly as she wanted it. In the second place, I think it gave her hands, her hands were busy, and her mind was busy with her piano playing, and that certain kind of brittle, almost hostile persona that she cast from the stage disappeared. I think it was because her attention was divided, and she became the sweetest, most wonderfully communicative singer. I often thought to myself during those moments, she should be playing for herself. She sounds so much better.
Why didn't she?
Why didn't she? I don't know. I mean, this is a question that only she could answer, but, you know, it just wasn't being done. You know, a piano player who plays for herself, I guess she felt that was limiting. She could probably get farther by being a single and standing up.
When you're playing for a singer, what are some of the things that you keep in mind when you're playing so that you don't interfere with their singing melody, but you support their singing melody?
Well, you know, this is assuming that you're a good accompanist. These are the things that a good accompanist will think of. And I'm still learning that kind of thing, where to stay out of the way and how to do it. I've often felt that I've been a rather intrusive accompanist, and I think back that singers must have been really bugged with me the way I played for them. I tend to play too much. I tend to inject my own thoughts into the accompaniment. And I guess underneath, I was never content to be totally anonymous as an accompanist. So there was always a little bit, and I'm basically a stylist as a pianist anyway, as opposed to an all-around journeyman. You know what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
So I felt that my weakness and shortcomings as an accompanist kind of resulted from that, my compulsion to be a stylist. It was hard. It is still hard for me to keep myself out of the singer's way and try not to comment too much.
It's because you're such a good pianist.
Well, I'm a good pianist, and I think I'm beginning now to be a really much better accompanist than I used to be.
Dave Frischberg is my guest, composer, songwriter, pianist, singer. Many people have done some of his songs. And there's actually a book of sheet music of your songs.
It's just out. It came out very recently. It's now in the stores, and it's called Listen Here, Songs by Dave Frischberg. It's published by Hal Leonard.
It's not like I could sit down and play the arrangements or anything, but I was looking through the book of sheet music, and in one of the songs it says, where it should say, you know, like andante or moderate tempo or something, it says conversationally. I thought that's perfect. Yes, that song should. It's not the kind of notation you usually see in sheet music, but I thought, yes, that's exactly right.
Well, it's not that uncommon, actually.
Really?
I think I've seen a lot of songs that have those kind of expressions, you know, forgetting the old Italian or German expressions. Conversationally makes a lot of sense. A lot of my songs sound so much better if they're sung conversationally. Like, I hear singers sing ballads of mine, and they hold those notes out because I know singers. They like to hear the sound of their voice, and they get caught up in how it feels and how good it feels to produce those tones. I think a lot of times it works against the song, holding notes out for a long time, you know. Sometimes I want to tell them, when I say conversationally, I mean, you know, you've got to throw that away. That's an aside almost, or that's a piece of discourse. It has nothing to do with holding a note out. Mm-hmm. But you can't tell that to a lot of singers, and you got to just, I'm not complaining, but a lot of times when I hear singers do my songs, I wish they wouldn't sing so much. You know what I mean?
Yeah, I do know what you mean. My guest is Dave Frischberg. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Dave Frischberg, a composer, pianist, singer. Many of his songs, like Heart's Desire, Sweet Kentucky Ham, have been recorded by other performers, including Rosemary Clooney. And he has a whole bunch of CDs that are around. There's another way you might know Dave Frischberg without realizing that this is him, and that is through, what's the kids' music show is called where they teach you how to add?
Schoolhouse Rock.
Schoolhouse Rock, yeah. Mm. And one of your songs from there is actually quite famous.
Isn't that amazing?
I'm Just a Bill.
I'm Just a Bill.
About how a bill becomes a law.
Yeah.
And this was even in the film Reality Bites.
That's right.
That's how well known it is.
Well,
among the generation that grew up with these shows.
Now, I wrote that in 1974, maybe. That's 20-some years ago, and it's still on. And a lot of people know this song, and it shocks me because I never paid much attention to it. I don't watch kids' television.
We have to play it.
I will. I'm just a bill. Yes, I'm only a bill. And I'm sitting here on Capitol Hill. Well, it's a long, long journey to the capital city. It's a long, long wait while you're waiting in committee. But I know I'll be a law someday. At least I hope and pray that I will. But today I am still just a bill. That was sung by Jack Sheldon in the original recording of that. Listen to this, Terry. A couple of years ago in Portland, a friend of mine was in the hospital. I went to visit him, and I went to his room, and there was like he was sharing a room with somebody else who must have been really sick because there was this big screen. I peeked behind the screen, and this other patient was ghastly pale, and he had all kinds of tubes stuck in every orifice. It looked like he was on his way out. So I was talking to my friend, and my friend says, "Well, what have you been doing?" I said, "Well, I'm working for Schoolhouse Rock again." He says, gee, that thing you wrote years ago, I'm just a bill, I still hear that. And from behind the screen came the voice of this other patient, and he said, "Did you write I'm just a bill?" And I said, "Yeah," I said to thin air, you know. And then from behind the screen, he began to sing it, the dying man singing my song, "I'm just a bill." I was like, oh, God, it was more than I can handle.
Oh, how odd. What a strange experience.
Very odd. You know, you never know when. I kept saying, "You're singing too much. Just do it conversationally."
You're still writing Schoolhouse Rock songs?
Yeah, they're back in action again, and I had three assignments recently during the past year, and we recorded them, and they're going to be on rotation. The new category is money management for children, and
which you know a lot about.
Oh, of course, and they immediately came to me for money management, and I wrote three songs for them during the past year. One is how to budget your allowance, and one is how to deal with banks about interest paying or either paying interest or earning interest. And the most recent one I wrote, which we recorded in New York a couple weeks ago with me and Grady Tate doing the vocal, is called Walking on Wall Street. You know, they're teaching kids how to monkey around with stocks and... Well, you gotta be cool when you're walking on Wall Street. Like going to school, you'll learn a lot every day. And remember the rule when you're walking on Wall Street. Buy low, sell high, take a piece of the pie. That's the Wall Street way. Now, the companies that manufacture things we use, like telescopes and videos and high-top shoes, are looking for investors such as me and you so we can own shares in the company, too, and so forth.
Yeah. That's terrific. You can have all these like little Michael J. Fox types singing the song.
Well, what they do is I write the song, or the songwriter that they use, the song is written first, and then Scholastic Rock mm-hmm. animates to the song.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's up to the songwriter to create the scenario, so to speak, and then the animators go to work on it and turn it into a cartoon.
There's a song I want to ask you to do that I think is a fairly recent song, although I'm not sure. You recorded on one of your recent records. It's called Snowbound. And it strikes me as being a song that's almost out of character for you because it's not quite the type of character you usually write for. It's not...
Yeah, this is... I guess, you know, I don't even have a character in mind at all for this. The reason I wrote such a song is because a lot of singers have been coming to me and they say, "We'd like to sing your songs, but can you write something? We don't want ballads. We want something with a little beat to it because we've got enough ballads. But write something," several of them have said to me, "that's not so weird that only you can sing it." And I know exactly what they mean.
Do they mean weird lyrically or
melodically?
Well, weird,
yes. And also from the fact that as we discussed, as I mentioned anyway, the songs that I write are written for characters, and a lot of singers kind of sense that they're written for a character and are reluctant to play a character.
Or they don't fit that character.
Or they don't fit that character, or they'd prefer to play themselves. So they asked me, "Can't you write something, I guess they want a little something more neutral," I call it, you know, something more neutral. This is my entry into the neutral lanes. The north winds blow
It's 12 below. Streets like ice, ain't it nice to be snowbound, snowbound? No place to go, hip deep in snow. We're all right, tucked in tight, 'cause we're snowbound. Yes, we're snowbound. The bad news is the weatherman says more bad weather. Snowbound. The good news is that here we are socked in together. The clock has stopped. The corn has popped. What a storm, what a sight. We'll stay warm through the night, 'cause we're snowbound, 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 and so forth. It fades off into the night.
I love the song.
It's odd because I went to Scandinavia and played this last summer, and I met a guy there who's translated it into Norwegian.
Oh, no.
And he sang it for me in Norwegian, and it's hip. I think I like it better in Norwegian.
I particularly enjoy songs like that in the winter. It's really nice to have those, like, you know, snow anthems when the weather gets really bad. So I'd like to close with another song. And I'd like you to close with another song, would be the more correct way of putting it. Let me ask you to choose something, and feel free to play something new if you wanted to that I couldn't possibly request because I wouldn't know it yet, or one of your classics, or anything you'd like, but I'm going to let you select it.
Okay. Have I ever sung You Are There on this program? Or?
No.
I really like that one.
Why don't you do that?
This is a song that's mine with the lyric only. The music was written by Johnny Mandel. And he submitted it to me, or gave it to me. He had shown it to a bunch of other lyric writers, he told me later. And he said, would you like to take a crack at this? And he gave me this long melody that had no rests in it. And it just went on and on. And I thought it was a very difficult assignment. And I wrote a lyric to it, and Mandel heard it. And he said, well, that doesn't quite make it. You can do better than that in so many words. And so I had to go back and rewrite the whole thing, which made it doubly difficult to try to do something again that you thought you'd finished. I ended up with a lyric that I was really proud of. It fit the odd metrical requirements, and it made sense, too. In the evening, when the kettle's on for tea, an old familiar feeling settles over me, and it's your face I see. And I believe that you are there. In a garden, when I stop to touch a rose and feel the petals soft and sweet against my nose, I smile and I suppose that somehow maybe you are there. When I'm dreaming and I find myself awake without a warning, and I rub my eyes and fantasize, and all at once I realize it's morning, and my fantasy is fading like a distant star at dawn. My dearest dream is gone. I sometimes think there's just one thing to do. Pretend the dream was true. And tell myself that you are there. Michael Feinstein made a record of that. And in the liner notes, he says, Dave Frischberg and Johnny Mansell's classic song about death. And I didn't even know it was about death. Now, every time I sing it, I think it's about death. But
gee, I wouldn't have thought it was about death, too, but that makes it even more moving.
Even more creepy.
Yeah, that's a beautiful song.
I like it a lot, and I'm proud of the lyric. It was a tough one to write.
That's Dave Frischberg, recorded in our studio in December of 1995.